Chris McIntosh, founder of Capitalist Exploits. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be back, Tom.
Chris, I feel like the level of absurdity is seemingly on an exponential growth chart right now, upwards over the last, let's say, 6 years. If we consider the level of insider trading, promises by the West to get politicians elected, then reneging on those concepts for their representation, markets being at all-time highs despite nuclear war being threatened and being maybe closer than ever, it really never seems to end here. Do you see this more as a function of more access to information or just the absurdity of our time and the symptoms of a system that is ready to crack and crumble?
I think there's a feedback system. And if you go through like hundreds of years of history, you have cycles and you have blow off tops. We are, I believe, in a blow off top. And a blow off top isn't just in terms of market prices. It's in terms of social, the way societies construct themselves socially. And so it's not actually a surprise that you get at times of market blow off tops, you simultaneously get like a gambling mentality and a frivolous mentality with respect to all sorts of things. So if you think about the fact that we apparently have 50 odd genders or whatever, right? That in itself is a social blow off top of insanity. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the two coincide. And then simultaneously with it, when you have these blow off top in markets, people at a fundamental level will realize that it's difficult to get ahead. So like when you get a person who's just working hard, maybe they're like a plumber or whatever, they're finding that there's actually a lot of hindrances to their life, higher taxes, the biggest tax being inflating away the underlying denominator, the currency that they use. And many people don't understand that, but they just know that their life is shittier than it was in the past, each passing year. And then simultaneously, they get, like we are getting now, tweets from the White House championing the NASDAQ and the S&P at all-time highs, okay? But these people are not participants in that. Or if they are, they're participants in that in terms of their 401k plans, which as a percentage of their net worth is meaningless or relatively meaningless. And so when their cost of living is eating into them and they're only got 10 grand or something like that, or 20 grand in a pension plan, it's immaterial whether that pension plan has gone from like 20 grand to 22 when their cost of living is biting them. And so the result from that is that they gamble, right? Because they see that as the only possible way out of this sort of encroaching world around them. Like they try and affect change with politics. But that doesn't work because the politicians are owned on both sides. It's a highway, and you get to pick a car, and you can have this car or that car. The red car or the blue car, and people, I think, slowly are waking up to the realization that it's the same highway. You can choose the color of the car, but it goes into the same destination. It might change speeds, but heaven forbid you pick one that wants to veer off the highway, because that will be eliminated. That's not allowed. and so these blow-off tops coincide with these collapses. From our perspective, being asset managers, our job, of course, is to try and navigate this, but to also ensure that we first and foremost protect our capital from the inevitable consequences, but secondly, to try and grow it. And that's a story that's as aged as humanity itself. And it's not a difficult one, actually, right? When you go through these periods, it's quite simple. You need to be diversified in terms of geographies, but you absolutely need to be owning essentially Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which incidentally are the cheapest they've been in both absolute and relative terms. So you own energy, you own precious metals, you know, own agriculture. All of these things are what you need to be owning. And I mentioned this the other day, was like the idea that we're now living in the age of consequence or consequences. The consequences to this insanity, the consequences to these actions that have long preceded us but are now coming to fruition, are going to be felt. And you just, you have to position yourself for that.
Chris, it's interesting that you frame that as being asset managers. I was reading one of your recent letters, and it was from some of your clients asking, when does this end? And I think your answer was, that's actually the wrong question. The right question is, who has an incentive to end this?
With respect to the conflict, I think that was a question with respect to the conflict. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the popular narrative is, oh, the West wants the Strait opened, for example, which I think is it's faulty if you actually just look, forget about the headlines and you just look at the actions being taken. Now, what we're seeing is a shutdown of supply, and it's purposeful. And it is, there's another thing out. So like there is no incentive from almost any party involved at the moment to end this war. Right. And I'll quickly run through that. So you've got the US, which is largely controlled by the Zionist lobby group, and they absolutely do not want this war ended. They have to take it out. We had Wesley Clark back in, what was it, 2014, I think it was, highlighting that this was going to take place. So this has been long in the cards, right? The pop, this sort of narrative around, you know, developing a nuclear weapon and all is obvious nonsense. So the US by default don't want the war to end. And people say, well, the US can't afford a ground force and all. That doesn't matter. The people pulling the strings don't give a flying toss whether the US exists as a nation after this or not. That's what perhaps to some degree people are slowly waking to that reality. So you've got that sort of Western, if you will, US-Israeli axis that doesn't want the war to end. Then you've got the Iranians. The Iranians know that if the war ended tomorrow, it's just a temporary reprieve until they restock and reload and come back again. And so their best strategy is to suck them in, is to draw them in. Because if you look at how empires have collapsed through Persia and Afghanistan and places like that, it's by attrition, right? So we know that it's going to be difficult to win a ground war. The US, I mean, the Pentagon have like modeled these for years and they always lose, right? So the Iranians they would actually want the war to continue for that reason, because that's the only way they could potentially actually finally defeat their enemy. And remember, they defeat by simply having them just bled out, right? then you've got the Russians. The Russians are fighting on the same enemy on a different front, on the Ukraine front. If you've got that battle going on and someone comes along and takes some heat out of that for you, you want that. So it's to the benefit of Russia to have Iran taking some of the heat out for them, right? So they want to have that continue. The Chinese are ultimately the prize at the end of this, right? And they understand that. You know, you have this rising superpower that is contesting US hegemony. And so they're quite familiar with and quite clear in understanding that their Achilles heel has been some of these resources, which they've been acquiring from both Iran and Russia. So it's not a surprise that their enemies are attacking Iran and Russia. it's a synthetic attack on China. They fully understand that, which is why they'll back them. So, and again, how do they defeat that enemy? By attrition. The only way you defeat an empire and one of such huge resources is by attrition. So they actually don't want that to end. So that's that. From that perspective, when you look at it from the parties that actually are involved, none of them really want this to end. But that brings you into this age of consequence. You know, going into this, we had lack of capital expenditure across these, certainly in the energy space, for over a decade. So that was, we were going to have a bull market anyway, conflict or no conflict. And there's multiple avenues on in terms of the conflict that actually bring about higher prices of everything. One is just when you go to war, you got to finance it. That means your debts blow out. And then you got to have to print the money in order to, or at least monetize the debt. That's always inflationary. I've never seen a war that's deflationary. So all these economists and investment talking heads who are suggesting that we're going to have deflation, I always ask them, show me where we've had geopolitical conflict that has been deflationary, and none of them can answer it. So these are all, and that would be true if you didn't have a lack of supply, and we have massive lack of supply. So, I mean, we're looking now at, gosh, the biggest oil shortage supply we had before was the Iranian oil crisis. And that took out 5.6 million barrels a day. Prior to that, you had the Arab Spring in 73. That took out 4.5 million barrels a day. We're currently at 12 million plus barrels a day. And it hasn't stopped. And the markets are like so complacent, so unbelievably complacent. On top of the fact that inventories are way down, they're draining the SPR. So, like, you know, Trump came out saying, oh, we've exported more oil than da, da, da. It's like they're exporting from the SPR. That's fucking nuts. So you've got all these missing barrels that have to be made up somewhere. And it's like people don't fully understand that. It's like people think of oil and they think of driving. No. Like, we eat it. We are it, right? About 40% of a barrel of oil is gasoline. The rest is diesel and jet fuel and bunker fuel and feedstock for, like, probably about 6,000 products, medicines, plastics, you know, surgical devices, clothing, electronics, contact lenses, toothbrushes, like all this stuff, right? And so people go, oh, no, this is good because we got electric cars. And I'm like, electric, so like 30% of global electricity supply comes from coal. Like, so it's not a surprise that we're long coal assets, right, as well. But again, this is where we're hitting this age of consequence. And largely it's also an age of consequence of a naivety. You know, you have all of these graduates coming out of these Marxist institutions in the West. They think they know it all. And they come out with these pontificating around things like clean energy, right? And they don't, it's clear they have no understanding at all of the fact that that the clothing that they wear wouldn't exist if it wasn't for the fossil fuel industry. I don't know. Like, I remember watching, this would be Mark 2018 or something. You had climate change protesters, and these clowns were in their yoga pants and their yoga mats protesting on London Bridge. And I'm like, you're wearing synthetic clothing with a fucking yoga mat. Like, that shit doesn't exist without a barrel of oil. And you're protesting a barrel of oil. Like, it's comedy, but it's tragic comedy. And now we're at the point where we're actually, like, we're facing those consequences. And then to the other point where you talked about, you know, the insanity. We are in this blow off top, but the beginnings of that have already started, and we've seen it in the precious metals market. That's gone first. So like you've got gold is in a bull market, or should we, the better way to rephrase this is most every indicator is in a bear market against gold now. Whether you take the Dow, whether you take the NASDAQ, the S&P, the Russell, the Wiltshire, even the dollar index, US M2 money supply, all of these things are in a bear market against gold. And we're rotating now to all these other components of the commodity index. And energy is going to be next. And energy is probably the most asymmetric of all of them. And so those, and again, this is, if you go back through history, this is exactly what happened. We've had these rotation events before. You had 1930s, you had 72, you had 2006, and this one is going to be the big daddy, like the really big daddy, in my opinion. So it's not difficult to sort of know where one should be invested, I think. And to all the people who look and say, oh, you know, you don't want to, like, we're at war now. So the price of oil went from, say, $55 a barrel at Brent, Brent to 107 or whatever it is today. You know, that's not a time to buy it. And I recently put out a report on this where, like, $112 oil, if you go in and you adjust it for inflation in terms of real purchasing power, mm-hmm. it's actually cheaper than the peak we had in 2008, which mm-hmm. so 2008 adjusted for inflation today is $210 a barrel. And so when I say to people we're going to $200 a barrel, they're like, I think I'm fucking growing another head. It's not. It's like all I'm doing is And by the way, in 2008, we did not have the same setup that we've got now with respect to 12 million barrels taken offline. And by the way, those 12 million barrels that are offline don't just come back tomorrow because they've begun capping wells. There's refineries that have been bombed. Carg Island and the Saudi facility that got bombed. Saudi Aramco came out and they said that if they began work tomorrow, they anticipate that they would get back to full product, well, they get the refinery back to full operational capacity in 2 to 3 years. Right? And so, like, and that's just one of the refineries that's been damaged. But then the other issue, of course, is they've begun capping wells because they can't move the oil. And so, just for people's information, once you cap a well, you can't just open it up again. Sometimes you've got to go back and re-drill it. That takes a lot of capital. And once you've re-drilled it, it's the percentage probability that it will flow at the same capacity as prior is lower. It'll either do the same or less, never more. So what you are systematically capping the existing flows to some degree. We don't, and that's if we stopped tomorrow and we started uncapping the wells, but they're not, they're capping them, more and more of them, right? Because you can't, like, if you're pulling it out of the ground, you've got no storage capacity, you can't stick it in any of the storage anymore because the storage is full and the tankers aren't taking from the storage, the whole supply chain's broken. What are you going to do? And so, like, I see these headlines around things like, you know, the UAE is exiting OPEC. Ah, and then people are going, well, that means they're going to produce more oil. I'm like, where? Where are they going to put it? Like, at the moment, they're full. The storage tanks are all full and they can't move it. So the ability now to produce more is immaterial. So, the age of consequences is here. And the other component, and you and I touched on this before, is geography, right? because you don't want to be the guy that's kind of got the cycle right and picked the right sector. And then said, I'm going to be really, really narrow, and I'm going to go and buy one or two companies. And those one or two companies might just be sitting in, say, Saudi, right, who can't move their oil. Like, you don't want to be that guy. So you either get super diversified across the energy space, and or you look at what geographies typically get contested and then which don't. And so it's not a surprise. And you were down in Buenos Aires with us. Was it last year, year before? And so like the things that are going on there in Argentina with respect to the energy market and all, now have a massive headwind because you've got an uncontested resources, and the oceans are protected and controlled in that jurisdiction. They're not contested. So these things are all matter, and you just got to play the game.
Well, Chris, I mean, the idea that you have some type of geographic or jurisdictional risk associated with not only obviously the laws around there, but also your access to energy, I think is really important. Do you see the same types of risks, let's say for North and South America from an energy availability perspective that the rest of the world faces that is heavily dependent on imports?
Well, that's where if you go and you look at what the US administration was doing prior to these wars, and I remember writing about it, I said what they're doing is they were consolidating and securing that north-south axis everywhere from Canada through to Argentina. And it included pressure on the Canadians. It included pressure on Mexico. It included pressure on Venezuela, Colombia. And a lot of what, you know, people look at is just what's on the headlines. And they go, oh, yeah, Venezuela, because there was, like, you know, some quasi-kinetic conflict there and so on and so forth. But what happens under cover, if you will, is just as significant. So the political pressure as well as probably the CIA involved in many of these countries pressuring to gain additional levels of leverage, i.e. control. That's happening all the time. And then you'll start seeing, like, we've got elections coming through now in Colombia. Chile's already swung pro. I suspect Colombia is going to swing pro-US, if you will, if you want to call it that. And that's just a matter of them securing that geopolitical environment. Brazil's the big one. And I've got her on good authority that that's certainly from a, shall we say, the shadow government. There's a huge amount of pressure to bring in, to get rid of Lula. So we'll see what happens there in the elections coming up. But that, and Milei is their boy. He's their boy. Now, you can like him or hate him or whatever, but from what I can tell, they're going to open that country up and they're going to exploit the shit out of it. And it'll be US companies. Now, to the degree that Argentines benefit from that, we'll see. I suspect things are moving in a fashion where they will, partly because they need, because it's such a large country, they actually need to have those resources put to work. I don't think it's going to be an extraction jurisdiction like much of Africa has been for sort of, you know, for years. But yeah, so from that perspective, I think Latin America booms. Now, then you step over to sort of the Southeast Asia, China axis there. There's a lot of consolidation that's taken place with the Chinese. That back in 2014, when they found that they could be sanctioned. Remember, they got sanctioned from the semiconductor industry, and you could see they panicked. Like the CCP basically collapsed their real estate market. They actively went in and they repositioned the whole country to start securing supply chains. But they're prepared for war. And so now coming into this conflict, you know, most Western commentators are like surprised. Why hasn't China collapsed? Like, it's like China has more storage of energy than the US and Europe combined. They have more storage of fertilizer than the US and Europe combined. They have, so like I could go on and on, but the point I'm making is that there's a massive miscalculation. Or maybe it wasn't a miscalculation from the West, but there was an understanding from the Chinese as to what was coming, and they positioned very strongly for that. So the battle's on. I think ultimately China is going to do pretty well. It's relatively cheap. So we have small weighting in China in small cap equities. I think we might have to wait a little time for that, but ultimately I think that's going to pay off pretty well. But outside of that, it's largely, you know, hard assets, commodity ownership. Europe, I have almost, like, Europe is going to go through a huge problem, I believe. The companies that we own, which are European, are mostly things like, you know, service vessels for the, say, offshore space, things like that, which actually they might be domicile headquartered in Europe, but they're not. Like they could be sitting in Ghana, you know, off the coast of Africa or wherever it is that they're working. So the listing of them is, you know, kind of immaterial. But and then we haven't even talked about the debt markets, right? The US market's problematic, the gilt market. I think there's two countries in the world that I think people should watch in terms of bonds. It's the French and the
English. Sorry, before we get to the debt markets, I wanted to just stay with the China theme for just a second more, if you don't mind. I recently read a book called Unrestricted Warfare that Craig Tyndale, previous guest of the show, recommended to me. And it was written by two Chinese generals, and it was very much about learning the lessons from the last war and understanding that the battlefield from the last war is not going to be the battlefield of the next war. So you mentioned this idea of a very strategic and deep fertilizer and energy stockpile in China. By those metrics, and please mention any others that you're aware of, is China really, let's say, the dominant or most strategic system at this point in time?
I like the fact you use the word system. Years back, maybe 2 years ago, I wrote a piece called Clash of the Systems. And I kind of think in terms of systems, right? Because it's easy to get caught up in ideologies. And as human beings, we tend to be tribal. So you're kind of like, oh, this is my guy or that guy, whether it be like you think about football or baseball or soccer in the UK or whatever it is, like everyone picks their team, so to speak. It's very, I guess, it's human nature because we're tribal, but it doesn't actually give you a framework to understand probability. When I think in terms of systems, it gives you an opportunity to think in probability. So if I look at economic systems, the economic system being utilized that we are now living in the West, not the one that we're told we live in, the one we actually live in, is a system of continuous extraction. It's a parasitic system, and it is moving rapidly towards a fascist system, right? It's this merger of government and state enterprise to the benefit of those select corporates. China has a different system. It's not one, like, again, this isn't about agreeing with or disagreeing with ideologies. It's just looking at these systems and how they operate and what they produce. And the Chinese system on net allows for more freedom and on an exponential path. So if you look at the sort of Western system, it is increasingly less free in that respect. And then the other component behind that is looking at valuations, right? Because you can have, let's say you've got a system A and a system B, okay? And system A is far more draconian or whatever it is, and maybe doesn't produce, maybe system A produces 2x, right? And system B produces 3x. You go, oh, I want to own system B. However, what if system B is priced at 100 times earnings and system A is priced at 6 times earnings, right? So now in order for you to actually benefit, like if you have the same trajectory from system B, which is too expensive, like you're going to struggle. You have to wait hundreds of years, sort of thing. So that's sort of how I look at it, is these different systems, and then again, valuations. And Chinese equities are undervalued relative on those, if I'm looking at systems. So, and yeah, you're right. It's like there's a lot that's gone into it, I think, in terms of how they've built those systems, and they have also been changing them and adapting them. I think that's another component that people have, maybe even myself, have struggled with, is we think of the system that you and I grew up with in our, say, 20s, right? And there's sort of in the back of our mind, because it's lodged there, like archived, we go, well, that's the system. But then if we entered that world today and we erased that knowledge that we had or that experience, and we said, oh, what are we dealing with now? Let's objectively look at it. What is that system? You and I would not recognize the system that we saw in the 20s. Like it's gone. It's finished. Mm-hmm. We have a totally different system. So you got to say, okay, well, that's the reality. Despite where it might have come from, that's the reality. And I think the same is true when you look at, say, the Chinese system. The system that existed 20, 30 years ago was not the same system. And so when I see that path and those two systems competing with one another, one of those allows for more productivity. And unfortunately, I say unfortunately because, again, we've got this history of knowing what can exist. I say unfortunately, it looks to me like that is the more productive system. And I'm sitting here, my job is to make money for my clients and myself. So I can't be ideological about it. I have to be realistic about it. So that's where I'm bullish on China.
Well, I think that type of thinking about changing your mind or trying to be far more objective about a new system, a new way of doing things, definitely applies to where you were going earlier in the debt markets, right? We now see the rise of stable coins. That is supposed to be, and I think will become an important demand vector for treasuries. But I think at the end of the day, the perpetuation of that type of system, the debt markets in general, once you reach, let's say, a mathematical, I don't want to call it an endpoint, but some mathematical threshold where your interest expense exceeds your incomes in essence, ends up, you know, not working. I think this is, despite having a new way to think about this, is a lot of where the West is. Is there a different way that you're thinking about that or approaching it that I'm kind of missing in that
so context? Again, if you go through like sort of 500 years of history, then you realize that empires collapse as a consequence of debt always. and overreach. There's a lot of other factors that are in play, but where you have a set of conditions that always exist in one thing. In other words, like a cake always has a flour. Like, you never had a cake that doesn't have flour. Maybe you probably do. Maybe I got the wrong analogy. But the point is, like, what is a cake? Well, it's always got flour, and maybe it's always got milk, and it's got sugar or whatever. And some cakes might have chocolate, and other ones might have strawberry, and other ones might have, like, raspberries and whatever. But, like, all cakes have flour and sugar and milk. When I look at empire collapses, they all have debt accumulation and debt collapse. And so when we're looking at the debt markets, the predictive outcome is quite easy to understand. And there's only two ways to resolve that. You can either inflate it away or you can outright default. And then there's all the second and third order consequences, things like repudiation of those liabilities, which we're now watching rolling out. And I've been warning about this for a long time. You know, if you have a pension plan, right, and it is in any way, shape, or form controlled by the government, and they all are, even self-managed ones, I would suggest, for me, I'm like, I have zero interest in it. Even if I'm getting tax breaks, I'm getting all of this. Like, it's the moment you don't have full control of that capital, it's not yours. And we're at a point in time where that will be stolen. Absolutely will be stolen. And it'll be stolen in such a fashion that most people will even argue that it hasn't been stolen. In other words, Tom, you've got this wonderful pension plan there, and you've built up these assets, maybe you got $1 million, but we've had this, you know, this market crash or whatever it is, and we're going to step in to make sure that things are safe for you, and that surety we're going to give you is that, like, we're going to mandate that 20% of those assets in your pension plan have to be invested into government securities, because government securities we know are safe, and we can, you know, we'll look after them for you. Well, they've just stolen 20% of your money, and they've just extricated. They've gone and they're taken, and they're going to end up bombing Putin with it, or eating babies, or child sacrifice, or any of these other. Like, they've stolen your money, and your average Joe Sixpack on the street won't even. They'll argue that no, that's still their money. Why? Because they pull up a digit on their screen and it says it's there. I mean, we're dealing with this now with respect to some of the private equity stuff we're doing in Argentina. Like, we essentially won't take Europeans, through certain vehicles, because it's just the laws and regulations around it make it, it's capital, they already have capital controls. And so those sorts of things are predictive of these market cycles and the predictive of the debt markets and all and all. But yeah, so, you know, the first question is where's that most problematic? I would say France and the UK are the most problematic at this point in time, but they're all problematic. And then the second thing is, well, what do you do about that? You know, it's A, knowing what not to own. Don't own bonds, right? Bug in search of a windshield. Don't. And then the second point is, you've got a structure, and this is where people fall apart, because it just falls into the too hard basket. You've got to structure those investments in entities that are out of reach from the parasite class. And there's entirely legal ways to do it. It gets into the point where people look at it and they say it's too hard. And it's not necessarily that it's too expensive. It's just there's a mind block. And some of that, I think, is actually just back to this entire cycle thing. You know, the average peasant in the street still thinks that the government is sort of, at least they sort of think they're incompetent, but they're actually there to help. And I think that's wildly optimistic, to be fair.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the idea of capital controls for getting, let's say, into and out of particular investments. But I think the other side of it is also interesting, Chris. You know, exit taxes, unrealized capital gains. These are also just more systems of this broken system that is not there to help you, right?
Yeah, 100%. And again, like, this isn't us pontificating around what may or may not be. A lot of this is already here, and you just need to go and read through history and see what happens when you get to these stages of debt accumulation and so on and so forth. And it's always the same thing. I had in the last issue of The Insider put out, I listed out all of the previous examples because I was highlighting how the Australians now are basically doing that with their pension schemes. The Dutch, of course, are going back and they're deciding this is such a great idea, this tax on unrealized capital gains, going back at it again. Anyways, and so, like, I think people get caught up in the, oh, will they or won't they, or like, and that's the wrong question. It's probability. The probability in these times, and I could have shown you this years back, is that this is what happens. Now your task is to ensure that you're nowhere near it when it or should it happen. Now, if it doesn't happen, you go, well, that's cool. Like, it's all right. I didn't want it to happen, but I sure as hell don't want it to happen, and I'm not prepared for it. So if I prepare for it and it doesn't happen, I've had a cost, right? Maybe it cost me $5,000 to set up some structure or whatever it is, but I'm good, right? So that's the better question to ask. Isn't like bitching and moaning around whether this person will or won't. And the thing that I've seen time and again through history that people get caught up in, and certainly in the West, because we've been led this lie about democracy, they see the answer to these problems as being some politician, right? So they go, I've got to vote for a different guy. And that's almost never the solution.
How did it work this time?
I mean, you could, the way I look at it, I'm like, you look after yourself first, sort yourself out. And then if you want to go and vote for some other person and hope that might bring about change, then knock yourself out. But the idea that you would put your life and your future in the hands of some other Muppet who's standing there at a podium preaching nonsense to you, to me, is infantile. That's what a child does. Like, you're not, and then this comes all the way back. How do you have empires collapse? Because the peasantry class become literally infantile. Look at the average, I hate to say this, average Westerner today is a child. They do not want to take responsibility for these things that they see coming. Even if you show them to them, they're like, oh, what a bit. It's like, grow up, make a fucking decision. Like, but it's difficult. I'm like, so.
But that's how we got here.
So that's how we got here. You know, weak men, hard times. Mm-hmm. And the only way you get out of it is to go through pain. You can choose whether you want to be participating in that pain or whether you are going to be the leader of your own life.
You know, it's interesting as we are, or certain countries, let's say not we are, certain countries are starting to experience some of this fallout from the Hormuz closure, you know, energy restrictions, the other, you know, consequences down the road, like food, fertilizer, plastics, as you mentioned. I saw India or Modi came out today and, recommended, let's say, his citizens not be buying gold anymore, avoid foreign travel, and cut fuel consumption to save foreign exchange. So is this, you know, another currency? Itself,
if you think about it, what you're protecting the capital within the country. So I grew up in Africa where you had capital controls. We couldn't travel outside of the country with more than, I can't remember what it was, 10,000 rand or something like that. Okay. This is the same thing.
Which doesn't go far.
It was the same thing. And so these are capital. Those are people won't look at that and go, oh, they're implementing capital controls. That's what they're doing. They're securing what they see. That's your assets. And they've decided that your assets should be, the moment a politician tells you what you should be doing with your assets is the moment you should be waking up. It's nuts. So, yeah, it's capital controls by different narratives, but they all amount to the same thing.
Well, and at this point, it's an ask, but at what point does it become a tell?
Well, it starts with an ask, and then it starts with the sort of creating, because what you need to do, the most effective ways to implement capital controls always, and this isn't just capital controls, the most effective way to implement any policy is to have the citizenry, the vast amount of citizenry, believe in that policy. Go back and think about the COVID scenario. How did you get people to walk around the streets covered with a fucking mask and stand 3 feet away from them, each other, and not visit their friends? And like, how did you get people to do such unbelievably stupid things? You needed to have them believe that that was the right thing for the community, because that creates a social pressure where they can then isolate and ostracize others, because we're, as social creatures, we're conformative because we want to be liked by other people. We want to have that social interaction. So what they do, they'll always lead with that. And that's what they're leading with now. Oh, you should stop travel. You should, like, you know. So then the next step that will come will be, that's not a very patriotic thing for that you're doing, because you went on holiday, right? And it's the same as you're hurting grandma. And then, of course, after that comes the, no, well, you know, all these recalcitrants who won't do as you know, they won't, like, there's always those people in society who don't do what they should do. What are we going to do with them? We saw the same thing with COVID. What do we do with the unvaccinated? As if it's a question. And then, of course, there's enough Muppets out there going, kill them all, kill them all. It's the same playbook being rolled out again.
Yeah, it's a competition on who is best at following the rules, not for actually thinking for themselves to realize what they're doing to themselves and greater society, right?
You literally have people who will champion their own demise all the way down. And some of them won't even, for all the Muppets who went and took the jab and have now got cardiovascular disease or anything like that, many of them will still champion it. They don't even, that people will go to their graves not realizing that they killed themselves. And you'll see, I mean, like, again, going back to my childhood, there was like what you would think were intelligent people within my own family who were like, no, we need to have these controls. You can't have people going on holidays and spending so much money and da da da. Like, they should spend the money in South Africa, right? Instead of going to Switzerland to ski. Like, how dare they? And they got to the point where they literally believed that. And it's like, as if that government really cared about you. It's unbelievable, but people will believe this and they'll go to their graves with a, what's that saying? People believe a comforting lie rather than an uncomfortable truth.
People would rather believe.
People would, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, Chris, does this time just underscore, you know, this is the age of consequences, as you mentioned. Does this really underscore a capital rotation style event and underscore the importance of actual energy, actual baseload energy, access to food, precious metals, things like that?
100%. 100%. I think that within 5 years, we're going to be calculating net worth in kilojoules and calories. Like, people, the denominator is wrong. Like, people, and you're seeing this now in the physical market in energy. There was a brilliant interview with Jeff Currie, the energy analyst, and he talks about the fact that You know, we've gotten so accustomed to pricing everything in dollars, right? And they just, so like you'll have these traders who are like, oh, well, the cost of like Brent crude is this, and that's just, it's a dollar. Everything's like dollars. But here's a question. What is the price that you will pay for what is the feedstock to literally humanity? What is the price you would pay when you have none? And that's
like I had.
That's the actual shortage. Not like, oh, the price has gone up. It's like actual shortage. Shortages don't matter when you've got a shortage of T-shirts. Like, right, fine, your cost of T-shirts goes up. But, like, people will handle it. They'll wear some other clothing, or they'll just keep their clothing a bit longer, whatever the case is, right? But when you've got the feedstock to humanity, right, when your fertilizers don't go in the ground, which means you don't have the same food and you're hungry and there isn't food, what is the price you will pay? If you've got like, and so you could have tons of bills. I mean, we look, to some extent, we've seen this now where the Gulf states have built up these massive hoards of treasuries. And they've always, you know, they've basically, it's the petrodollar system. They recycle their capital back into the treasury market. And one of the reasons that Bessent went over to the UAE and gave them a swap line was A, because they now, like, it's a rainy day and they're like, fuck, we need it. It's raining, right? And we got to buy food and we got to spend some of these treasuries. And he's like, no, we're at war. The last thing we need is you dumping treasuries on the market. We'll give you a big credit card, yeah. And then the next thing they did was like, we'll exit OPEC, right? So that, it's a promise. In the future, you'll be able to print as much oil as you like. I think it was a myopic, stupid thing for the UAE to do. But at the same time, they don't really have too many options in front of them. They set themselves as a peasant class leashed to the dollar and leashed to the US military system. And now they're paying age of consequence. Mm-hmm. Now they're paying the consequence. And so... but I think that's the way to think about things is actually not in dollar terms, you know. It's like Andrew, my partner in the private equity thing, and I were talking about this, and we said, you know, it's like this is the casino. It's like you just leave the casino, ask yourself. Like, it's not about asking yourself what's the price of something. It's like, what do you actually own? Ask yourself, what do you actually own? What do you, like, because you can have a digits on a screen and you could sort of say, well, I kind of control it. It's a bit like the pension plan. Oh, you know, you got government bonds that we have to invest in. People now go, well, I still got, I don't know, so many thousands of dollars. It's like, what do you actually own? You know, what do I control? Like, that's quite different. That's different to like walking outside and being like, I have a farm and there's cattle there and I can shoot that bastard, skin him and eat him. Like, that's what you own. That's so, but back to your point about this, this rotation. Yeah. Again, this has happened in the past. It's not particularly sort of unique. It's unique insofar as our lives. You know, we look at that and we haven't seen it in our lives, but yeah. And at the moment, you're looking through this hype in AI. It's a mania. You know, you've got these companies which not only don't make money, they torch capital, and they're trading at sometimes $1 trillion valuations. You know, so SpaceX is going to list in, what's it, August, September, Anthropic, OpenAI. Like, this, I think, is just the blow off top. And we're going to look back on it like we did look back on the Tulip Mania or the Mississippi Scheme or what else did we have after that? Yeah, the Weimar Republic in the 20s, then you had the 29 crash. Like, they're all very similar. Now we've got, what is a digital casino today? I don't see how the consequences aren't any different. And so what you're tasked to do is exit the casino before everybody else does.
Do you think the rise of crypto has been one of those ways of, or different vectors of maybe different casino games within that casino?
Yeah. You know, it comes back to what we were talking about before with respect to when your average person can't make it in what is just a productive enterprise, bakery down the road or like auto mechanic or whatever it is, and then they see others doing well from things that aren't particularly productive. Human nature is such that they will go after that. You know, that's how we have fucking Instagram influencers. Like, what is that? It's just narcissism as far as I can tell. But it seems to be like a quick, easy way to make money. By the time this is all over, we're not going to have any Instagram influencers. We're not going to have celebrity chefs. Like, what the fuck? No one's going to, like, you're not going to pay someone to be a celebrity chef. Like, it's just, it's going to be nonsense. So it all coincides. You know, you go. It's interesting. I studied the preceding the Weimar Republic and what the social environment was like. It was the same thing. You had trannies all around. You had this sort of liberal thing. It was a gambling, free flowing, do whatever the hell you want type of social environment. And of course, without any robust, cohesive thing holding communities together that then ultimately produce, and they produce like good children and like good education and good businesses. Without that, it just all falls apart and everybody ends up trying to gamble against everyone else and the whole thing collapses. And we're at that point now where that's it. So you've got to exit the casino.
You know, it's interesting to think about the idea of not only what you own, but also what skills you have available, right? What skills you actually have acquired in that are not directly tied to relying on somebody else. If you have to, as you said, you know, butcher your own cattle, do you have the ability to do something like that, even if you have mm-hmm. that asset?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the rotation. I had to think about that on an expanded view. How many mining engineers have been exiting universities over the last decade? I'll tell you, it's way down. I don't know the exact numbers, but I looked at this a few years back. Nobody wants to go into mining engineering. No, they want to get a political science degree, or they want to become an Instagram influencer or some nonsense. Nobody wants to be a farmer, right? Like, yeah, your average man our age probably doesn't know how to go and shoot an animal and kill it and turn it into meat. And so, I mean, you could go across all sorts of different avenues, but by and large, the other thing that we've had is increasing specialization as the world's got more and more globalized, and that's now coming apart. So we're going to have to move. We're going to, by force, move back into a world where supply chains are under pressure. So you're going to have much more locally produced and locally sourced products, and the countries that fail to do that are just going to have much, much lower standards of living. But it's going to force that. Now, I could see that AI can actually benefit that, right? So that could be a really useful vehicle. Let's just say, for argument's sake, you and I were living up in, say, Alberta, where you are, right? And they split, which they're talking about doing. Okay. And you have collapse in supply chains where we can't get certain things. And there's a shortage of, I don't know, like metal ingots. And you and I haven't done that. But the first thing that we'll do is we'll jump onto AI and be like, how do I go? How do I do this? And we'll research. So our speed of education will be lightning fast compared to back when we were 20 and we had to go to the library and find a book on it and try and find some guy down the road who maybe knew about it and like learn from him. And that whole learning process was a much more friction-based learning process. Today, we can do it much more quickly. The issue with AI, and the same is basically true of any of these tools, especially social media, the vast populace will always use it for entertainment and not as a, they will be used by it and they won't use it, right? Your average 20-year-old kid is used by social media. They are the product. There's a very few percentage of them who looked at it and gone, I could use this as a product and I can create something and go out and make money out of it. So the same is true in any respect. But back to the whole sort of, you know, metal ingots or iron ingots or whatever, you know, we would figure out how to do that probably more rapidly. And then we'd go about implementing a business plan to go and make them domestically, right? Because now we'd realize that there's massive margin to be had if there's none of them coming in from, say, China or whatever it is. We go, cool, we can make a ton of money. How do we do this? Let's go. So that, I think, can augment and develop and it'll be very good for communities. But then that would be much more locally produced and operated.
Yeah, I think a good way to put it is trying to become a creator rather than a consumer of, you know, Instagram is a good example, but many of these different skills and or information, to be an actual creator of it, to refine your thoughts, to put it in a digestible form is far harder than consuming it, right? And I think that just trying to shift that mindset into being creative for even a couple hours per week is far more difficult when you've become entrained to just be a consumer of information and or social media or, you know, pick your poison, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's like, and I don't know how you get there. Like, I guess education is one thing, you know, you train like your kids to think in that fashion, right? And not to be frivolous. That's one thing. And so that's like your whole education system. The other one is just necessity, right? And so again, you go through these cycles.
Yeah.
Right. And so like I'm convinced this is going to happen anyways, but it's going to happen not because we've looked at it and gone, oh, we should do that. Let's go and change our curriculum. Let's try and build our youth so that they've got the skill set to actually do this. Like, it's going to come because they're going to go, fuck, I'm hungry. What do I do? Or we don't have this, or we don't have that. And life sucks because like, it's just hard. So the necessity comes out as a consequence. And you see this at a very rudimentary level. I know you went with our buddy Francis and you rode motorbikes across Southern Africa, right? So like, you guys would have seen some of those little villages and like, you have, they'll build shit out of nothing, right? Like, and you're like, what? Because they don't have much and they're like, I need something. And they'll take some old wire coat hangers or like, you know, get those, always think of those, you know, those metal cars they make out of coat hangers.
Yeah.
And like, you look at them and it's like, it's amazing. Like, and the kids make them, like 6-year-old children make these little cars. I don't know if people listening, they're like, they're made out of coat hangers. They make the wheels, they make the steering columns, and not just like something that looks like a car, like it functions, the wheels turn and it's got a steering wheel and all. Anyway, the point I guess I'm making is like, that's necessity. That's children under necessity with a creative bent, and they go like, you know, how do I do this? So
with the old luxury of boredom.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, Chris, I appreciate having a wider ranging conversation. I know it might be a little depressing for some people, but I think it is very essential to realize the world that we have rather than understanding that the, or hiding from it, right? And it's always a valuable conversation with you. Is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners to think about before we wrap up today?
No, I mean, I agree with everything that you said. I guess that it doesn't necessarily need, like, the things that are taking place, they are what they are. Try not to think of them as necessarily sort of good or bad, if that makes sense. They just are. And then, because depression, I think, doesn't come from something being bad. I think it comes from something being bad and having an inability to do something about it. That lack of control is what's depressing, right? When you see a problem and you can go and fix that problem, that's actually not a depressing thing, right? Like if you've got something like cattle outside, let's say, you know, one of them's broken through the fence and it's got into another paddock. I'm like, it's a problem, but like I can fix it. Like I'm just going to get the bugger, stick him back and fix the fence. Like it's a problem that if I know I can solve it, I can actually come away with a productive outcome. And I go, now that fence is fixed and he's not going to get out again. And maybe I'll put a hot wire on it and then he's never going to get out again. And it's like, it's good, right? So now my life is better on a go-forward basis than it was before, because previously I didn't have a hot wire and now I'm like, okay, I need a hot wire. And so like where you've got an ability to actually produce an outcome, that's when something's not particularly depressing. So I would look at this and always try and say, what can I do about it? And just work on that, right? You came to our Mavericks event and that was it. It's like, it's solution driven. Like, stop bitching and moaning about the state of the world. Like, we get it. Like, what are you going to do about it? Let's build solutions. And the moment you start building solutions, like you wake up in the morning, you're like, this is cool. Maybe it doesn't work and I die, but like you feel much better. So that's my opinion on the matter.
Well, taking action and having some agency in the world certainly produces a far better mental state and typically reality for you once you have taken that action. And you're going to course correct. Of course, you're going to make mistakes, but doing something about it is a hell of a lot better than just trying to ignore it.
Same.
For those that want to read more of Chris's work, it's all available at Capitalist EXP on Twitter and, of course, capitalistexploits.com. Chris, always a pleasure, sir. Thank you so much. Yeah. What's that?
I said .at, but I think .com is also hosted and takes you there.
Okay.
Yeah. Perfect.
Chris, thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome.